Hello and welcome back to Canine Bingequake, the groundbreaking show where the robot dog does, in fact, make it out of the closet somehow. I'm Kevin, and I am joined, as ever, by my co-host Tom.
Hello.
And this week we have another special guest. Moon, would you like to introduce yourself?
I would love to introduce myself. It's one of my favorite things to do. Hi, I'm Moon. Moon J. Cobweb. I can be found on Facebook at Jacob Leo Webb. I am a writer, butler, playlist composer, and community support officer for West Sussex County Council. I can also be found on Twitter at AnfiBoy, capital Anfi, lowercase boy, or emailed at j_leo@outlook.com.
That was remarkably thorough. Thank you.
That was very thorough.
You've done this before.
Never. I just want lots of fan mail.
Yeah, this is your first podcast, is that right? This is your first podcast.
Yes. Yes, this is me entering the world of, I suppose, meaningful fandom.
Yes, meaningful.
Well, meaningful, yeah.
I'm an existentialist. Nothing has true meaning, but you know.
Oh, you're speaking my language, and this is way deeper than this episode deserves.
I don't know. There are some weighty themes somewhere in here.
Well, you would know because, as you've told us, you've watched this thing 3 times.
Well, look, I mean, we were supposed to record earlier in the week, and the first time it just slid straight off my brain, so what I did was watch it again, and then we delayed recording, and my partner came down to visit, and so I decided to inflict it on him as well. For a second opinion.
Very, very cruel.
Look, misery loves company.
My partner left the room when I was watching this episode, so I think that tells you everything you need to know.
Your partner is saner than my partner, yes.
I watched this like a dirty secret in the dark in my room with nobody around. That's where it belongs.
And we only ever watch it once, so, you know, really, Moon, you should probably, you know, run the show from now on. but that would involve watching more episodes, so.
That's probably going to happen to me is the thing. I doubt this is the last episode. There are two options, actually. One, I only ever watch this one, but I keep watching it. Or two, I watch the others. And each is as terrifying as the alternative.
Well, fear is the theme of the week, isn't it?
There we go. I'm always on topic, always.
Let's start from the top then. What did you know about this show already, the Australian Canine spin-off? Had you heard of it? Did you know much about it?
I knew that it had been produced somewhere in the world sometime. I knew that some people historically associated with the character of Canine were involved in some level of the production, wasn't sure which. I knew that it was made and set in Australia, which is much like knowing the Earth is flat, you know. I knew that there was a new prop for the character of Canine.
Yeah.
I knew that it was set in a dystopian near future.
Yep.
So
a few of the headline things, basically.
Yeah, that might be it. That might be the sum of my prior knowledge, yeah.
Okay. And so now you've seen this episode, episode 6, and Fear Itself, as it's called, and you've not seen any other episodes prior to this, like... most of our guests. You've also not heard any episodes of the podcast, is that right?
Hand on my heart, I promise I avoided any spoilers of any kind for this podcast or this television show from the moment that I understood that you wanted people going in blind.
You understood the assignment.
That's how you prefer it.
And you managed to restrain yourself.
Yep. You sure you weren't just doing that to protect yourself from this show?
Look, I mean, you set me some easy homework. Don't watch K9 like I had done the rest of my life.
Oh, very good.
Oh, how was this surreal experience for you coming in pretty much blind?
That's a broad question. It was mortifying, and I think I'm changed forever.
This is what we like. This is the good content. Mm-hmm. First impressions then. Just give us some of your first impressions.
I don't know. You want broad impressions or you want me to sort of just
Let's go with
have
broad impressions.
Okay, I'll save sequential notes for later in the recording. It was bad. It was really, really bad. I have only really watched good film and television for a while now, and obviously I've had to engage with some amount of Chibnall or Doctor Who, so you know, I watched Revolution of the Daleks on New Year's Day this year, and that's the most comparable experience. And there are differences. I think it's about as bad as that, but differently mixed, but we'll get to that.
I think there's a similar degree of plotting issues with this and the weaker Chibnall episodes. I can see the comparison for sure.
Yeah, I mean, would I call Revolution of the Daleks one of the weaker? That's a separate question. Broad impressions of this. The casting was bad. The acting was bad. The dialogue was bad. The delivery's probably come under acting. The costume design was non-existent. The set design was mostly appalling, although I will admit that the main set of the house is honestly pretty nice.
Yeah, that's all right. Yeah,
it's a confusing space. I don't really understand it as an environment, but it's a fancy house and it's a well done one of those. Sure, yeah, okay.
I'll just pick up on one of those threads, actually, mentioning set design. So this is quite a nice place to start. Quite a bit of this episode takes place in a junkyard in which there is a weird wooden box with huge interior dimensions. Does this sound familiar to anybody? some sort of deliberate nod, I imagine, to the parent show. Just starting on that weird wooden box, it's a little bit Narnia-esque as well, because it's kind of wardrobe-y, I guess, in a very vague way.
One might even say a closet, although I think the queer subtext reading of this story is strained.
Yes.
You mean Starkey and Kane aren't boyfriends? They declared their love for each other in this episode.
They did.
There's a lot of awkward camp. If I wanted to, with a sufficiently sharp hatchet, I could get there. But strained is all I'm saying.
There is also potentially a reading of...
Can I ask a question about the plot? Because I'm kind of lost on this episode, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
Are you directing the question at me, the resident expert?
What was the closet?
The episode does not answer the fundamental question of what, if anything, is going on in this story. And that's one of the more interesting things about it. It sort of refuses to take a stance on whether its metaphor is literal or not. Yeah. But I think that's ineptitude rather than a postmodern commitment to ambiguity.
Although,
there are some deep themes in there somewhere in relation to the subjective and the objective. It's in there, but I can't tell.
It does feel incoherent. Yeah.
Yeah. Like there's some sort of global rioting and a rise in societal fear going on somehow.
Mm-hmm. That's more or less how we kick off.
That's been found like some warehouse.
Mm.
So the closet is leaking fear or something.
Or the fear is caused by the totalitarian dictatorship and the closet is a consequence of it.
It would be very funny if
the
closet
was
just
summoned.
Yeah. A Listen-esque ambiguity where there's just it's never clear whether there was just nothing in the closet and everyone was just scared of a closet would have been quite nice. But unfortunately, things do seem to happen when you go into the closet. So can anyone summarize that for me? What happens when people go into this closet of fear?
Well, as the leading expert in canine fear itself, I will try my best to summarize. The interior dimensions of the closet rapidly expand if and only if that person has a fear that is in some way relevant to closets. Notably, a number of characters go near it and don't experience it expanding either. The text is saying that they genuinely have no fears whatsoever, which I don't think it's saying, or the fear has to be in some way thematically relevant. Which is one of the ways that we could plausibly get to a queer reading.
Or plot useful.
There's that moment where Georgie mentions she's feeling her fear of her mother, but it doesn't work the closet's magic.
Yeah.
Yeah, if anything, actually, a notable motif in the dialogue is trying to amp up the idea that Bogeyman is a sort of more of a myth than a piece of folklore, which is a tiny, tiny niggle of a nitpick of dialogue that has many, many greater flaws than that slight semantic misstep. But I am sure it annoyed you too, Tom.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's, like you say, there's so many things to focus on. You sort of don't know where to start.
I have bullet points.
Okay. Go on. So tell us more about the closet and the fear and how does that seem to work? Because it's very unclear.
Okay. At one point, you have to bear with me. I've watched this three times. I haven't managed to absorb character names very well. So there's your guy, the baddie, you know, business kid. He's about 20 at most and seems to be an adult. Nobody in this is cast a sensible age. Nobody.
The Do you mean the blonde kid?
No, the baddie.
Him. Oh, Drake.
Yes.
So he's probably the worst actor of them all, actually. We were talking about this in a previous episode.
Yeah, he
he's
is
so
trying
bad.
Some of the hardest, but he's working at some of the worst handicap. Yeah. I found Starkey pretty awkward, to be honest.
Yes.
But anyway, yes, he is having he has several uncontrolled meltdowns, and one of them, the first of the several, and the first of two which are by the closet, the one that doesn't end with him punching it to death with his robot hand, the closet does have a clawed tendril extend out from it, giving the distinct impression that there is a literal entity in there.
Yeah, we're left wondering, is there an alien? Is there a fear entity that is just an alien with a big, squiggly tentacle?
If you do step inside it and you do have a fear, which is in any way thematically relevant to closets, or cupboards or wardrobes, enclosed spaces, boxes, whatever, then its interior dimensions expand until you're hanging over a pit. And then this happens to the blonde one at the start of the episode. He gets shoved in there by some really, really offensive stereotypical homeless people.
Yes. God, the tramps were so cringy.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I could not watch that.
Watching
it was... Oh.
I could not watch that three times. And the first time, the very first time. I did, and that's why it really hurts. The very first time that I watched it, as they appear, my brain just, you know, sort of picking up on the very early noughties aesthetic vibe of the thing, like, was like, oh, you know, this is a show spinning off of New Who, particularly in the immediate aftermath of RTD1, and this is going to be some social commentary on homelessness. This is, you know, this triggers memories of bits like the Edge of Steel or Last of the Time Lords Part 1, and this is going to in any way engage with the fact that this, you know, fascist dictatorship has caused mass homelessness, and that's very tragic. And then it's just so offensive.
They're comedy yokels, aren't they? They're basically comedy yokels straight out of the Pertwee era. It's the modern day version of the Pertwee era comedy yokel.
I dare say worse, but which that's a poor measure of social progress. Anyway, right. So yes, they shove him in, and that's the first glimpse that we get of it. Although we don't see him fall down, we never learn how he got out. He just shows up about one scene later. Fine.
Just saying.
Foreshadowing.
Yeah, and then the scene that I know that it's a complete standard within basically all television, that if people are watching television on television, they'll be watching the news, and the news will be relevant to the events going on in the episode. But it still managed to feel lazier and worse written than that trope for them to be watching the news and it to be very parodically exactly about what was going on, to the point that I thought it was setting up something when they pan over and all seem mystified that the thing he was just describing is being described on the news. But no, that's...
It's just a nice coincidence.
Herring.
Yes.
Yeah. You were baited by thinking this was a better show.
Yeah, you obviously came in with high expectations that
that
were not
met. I came
met.
In with any expectations, I guess. You know, so just an assumption that this having been broadcast ensured a level of coherency and quality that I can... we do eventually find out what happens when one is within the space of the closet with fear of closety spaces or similar. And that is because at the end of the episode, after going through an arc of discovering that he is capable of emotion, K-9 falls down the hole, and it's sort of barren, dark, formless space. And I think you are menaced by a monster largely unrelated to your fears, yes. or that you're also afraid of, but not to do with the core fear yeah. that allowed you access to the space.
Very good.
A clarification on that monster, just quickly, you know, as a note. That was the monster from the first two episodes of this show. It was pretty terrible, and the idea that yeah. K-9 is terrified of it in any way is absolutely hilarious.
It is, it is. So if you've seen yeah. the first few episodes and you've seen the Jixen, you know this is just a giant fiberglass turtle that vomits on you. Then the idea that K-9 is, yes, out of all the sort of adversaries and things that he's faced, this is the thing.
I got the instinctive impression that it was, pathos. You know, the show's Simsha, if you will, you know, something that it's attempting to set up as a big lore. We'll bring this guy back when we need an iconic of our own creation monster. And I can't say as it landed in a few blurry shots there. And I'm not at all surprised that that's because there's nothing for them to work with.
Those shots were the best it's ever looked.
Yeah, I can believe that.
So yes, you end up in this weird black void, as K-9 does. Okay, let's talk a little bit about K-9, actually, because you mentioned Moon that he goes through an arc. Yes. And I'd said to Kevin a little bit earlier that in some ways this is the best the show has ever used him, which is not a high bar. This is not a high bar, because the rest of the show, he's mostly sort of been... how would you put it, Kevin? He's kind of just been taken out of action a lot. And
yeah, he's been sort of the plot device / comic relief. And whenever they don't want him in a scene, that he'll get thrown in a bin or he'll get high or whatever.
He'll get high?
These are all things yes. that have happened.
I want more about that at some point, but we can
well,
keep that out
listen
of this
to episode
recording.
Three. Okay. But no, yeah, he's kind of just been, yeah, a lot of these kind of silly jokes about how he doesn't understand, you know, kind of human humor and things like that. But this episode tries to do, I guess, a sort of staple of lots of science fiction shows eventually, where the robot character or the android character or whatever is curious about emotions and feels interested in emotions and is disappointed that they can't feel emotions. And obviously curiosity and disappointment are emotions, so it almost never works for me, you know, the whole yeah. android tries to learn about emotions storyline. It's
yeah. Yeah.
But at least it is something they are trying to do with K-9.
We've been never given a good reason to think K-9 doesn't have emotions. This is probably the fundamental issue here.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Well, the thing is, K-9 is basically 90% the same character as Data from Star Trek. It's just that K-9 is doing a really committed puppy play service sub bit his entire time. That's his thing. He's the robot who sort of thinks that he has no emotions, but very evidently has an amount of, you know, at least one basic emotion. In the case of Data from Star Trek Next Generation, it's a sort of sweet vulnerability. And in the case of K-9, it's sort of being a bratty sub. He's a bit sarky, you know? That's his thing.
This is my favorite thing that's ever been said on this show.
You're welcome. Partial credit goes to my partner Malcolm, with whom I am currently watching all of Classic Doctor Who in preparation for watching all of New Who in preparation for suffering through the Chibnall era that I haven't watched in order to then be able to approach RTD2 with full context. And we're at the moment just beginning JNT, so we've trudged through the highs and lows of the Williams era, which honestly,
so you've seen quite a lot of classic
it.
K-9 lately then.
Yes, K-9 has been aerosolized into the context of our lives over the past several months. So I've got a real grounds for context comparing this K-9 to, you know, the base K-9, the platonic ideal K-9. And speaking of platonic ideals, I want to complain about the prop, because like, K-9, the thing is that this show exists because K-9 is good. That's why there's a K-9 spinoff, because K-9 works. And K-9 works despite all reason. Someone, somewhere in the BBC in the 1970s said, knock together a comedy dog robot prop for this bad Baker and Martin story. And somebody else, just that day, hit the ball so ridiculously far out of the park that they created one of the most beautiful robot dogs ever. There were robot dogs in toy shops throughout my childhood, and they never, ever looked at all good. Robot dog is surprisingly hard to do. There's a complicated uncanny valley going on, and K9 just nails it. Just the simplest, most abstract depiction of a dog that allows you to project all of your sense of dogness onto it. And you change anything about that and it falls apart. And this changes a medium quantity of things. You can still tell that it's K9. But ironically, it actually looks more like a furry than slightly betraying my earlier kink interpretation of K9 as a character. Like this... This is a robot furry dog, not a robot dog. And yes, I feel like a cat having its fur stroked back. You know,
it's definitely a recurring thing for the show for us that K9 just isn't quite right. And in this episode, he seems to think that he's not quite right either, because as I've said earlier, he seems determined to feel emotions. He's curious about them. He's trying to understand, you know, what the point of feelings is, and he said at one point he thinks they're a system error, all that sort of thing.
Generic robot dialogue, yeah.
Generic robot dialogue. There is, we should mention, the bizarre sequence where they try to teach K9 about fear by dressing up in Halloween outfits.
Now, you know what? I will actually moderately defend the girl one in that, and I have heard, subsequent to watching this episode, but prior to recording this, I have heard that she is a strength of some of the prior content, and I have to say, she's not great here. She's not amazing.
It's not her best episode, is it? Yeah.
She looks, and this isn't a complaint about her at all, but she does look a bit like a young Disney-made clone of Sophie Aldred.
I hadn't had that thought. Yeah, we've generally made the Emma Watson comparison, because she tries to do it that sort of accent, but yeah.
Yeah, I could... Oh, God, no. We'll get onto the accents in a minute when I complain about, or theorize about, the setting of this story. But... clinging on to my point, she does admit, and this might just be bad writing, but she does admit shortly after they stop ghouling about, that if anything, they're not really trying to teach K9 the nature of fear. They're actually just sort of pissing about to distract themselves, because they're underlyingly scared by the base fear thing that's going on in the background in this story. And this is, you know, they're having a laugh to take their minds off of it. And I think that's actually a good rationalization for what a bad attempt that is to teach the concept of fear to a robot.
If I could just also just back up to the sort of uncanny comparisons between this K9 and the TV show K9, one of the biggest failures in this episode for me was the emotional relationship between Starkey and K9, where it shouldn't be hard to build a master dog relationship that feels believable. I mean, it's not like the doctor's relationship to K9 was a terribly well-developed thing, but I did not feel any of that affection. So when the whole episode hinges on K9's relationship to Starkey and them being scared of losing each other, I was just like, oh, piss off.
I have not, this is not me leaning on my expertise, this is me leaning on my lack thereof, I have not any context for whether they are established as the closest pair in this little unit or anything such. I don't know how K9 came to be with these people. I don't understand who or what Starkey is, really. There's an interrogation scene about midway through the episode where he sort of comes off as a bit of a doctor analogue. You know, he's being calm in the face of a megalomaniacal fascist who's slowly disintegrating at him, and I think I love what that scene wants to be.
Yes, that actually, I would genuinely say that is probably the best he's been, in a way. I don't know, yeah. Like he's kind of terrible, but he's you know, he's in prison. He tries to stand up to the Drake character, and he kind of does a decent job. He makes him look pathetic and paranoid, and you know, blah blah blah.
It's the first time I've really bought his character is defined as being sort of a protester hacker type. That's the first time I've really bought him being meaningfully a protester who understands how to stand up for himself.
But I definitely agree that the whole bond that he seems to have with K9, something the show seems to keep on insisting on in previous episodes, it's never really been fleshed out or rationalized, or you know, it's a weird thing. It's not enough to hinge this on, for sure.
And leads to the awkward line, K9, you're my K9, which no,
I was screaming at that.
No one talks to dogs like that. That's no one almost talks as good. To talking dogs like that.
That's almost as good as my favorite line, which is, my binary system is not happy. Let's boogie.
Oh my god, K9 saying let's boogie is a profoundly weird moment. That is...
But would the world not be a poorer place if it didn't exist?
It has enriched reality by some definition, I will concede.
I also think, actually, there's a bit of an issue with John Leeson delivering the lines, which I don't normally say, but I think I mean, it is because the lines are weak, but also he just can't do the scared canine version that he's supposed to be doing, and the kind of fearful thing and the sort of trying to, you know, feel emotions canine at the end. It just doesn't come across as what it should be. I don't know if you guys felt that as well, but...
Yeah, I do agree with that point. I will say, obviously, Leeson is... by a country mile, shall we say, the most experienced person in this entire production, and has had such privileges as working personally with Tom Baker in the past. You know, he's a veteran, and having him on board this project legitimizes it to a degree that it honestly doesn't deserve. So by and large, he's acting circles around everybody else and manages to anchor K9 in feeling like a character, which almost nobody else does. And obviously the material, as can happen when you transpose a supporting character into a lead role in a spin-off, requires that character to be slightly broken and remade, and remade a slightly broader kind of character. And that requires a slightly broader range of performance. And they've gone for the interesting choice of therefore having him emote more with his inflection.
Yep.
But digitizing the voice effect to counterbalance, which makes it sound canine-ish, but not quite like the character of K9, does give us, I think, actually my favorite line, the exasperated K9 saying, "Did Newton and Einstein live in vain?" Which you just can't imagine K9 saying.
Yeah. It's a very... I mean, it's a very human perspective on science, and a very old-fashioned one. I've said before that I feel like this show is sort of like, it feels like an extrapolation of Classic Who, as though the modern series never happened, and then done cheaper and worse.
Well, it feels like they've seen some blurry stills of the Davies era of New Who, to be
and
fair.
Especially of the Tennant Doctor, I think, because they're clearly trying to make Griffin sort of... I think someone, a previous guest, I think it was Molly, described the Professor character, Professor Griffin, as the Tennant Doctor if you got him off Wish. yeah. That's who he is.
I think Malcolm described him as a discount Giles in a similar vein. And I don't dislike him. He's not a good actor. None of them are good actors, but I don't completely dislike him. For some reason, having watched this three times, I come around to quite liking the blackboard scene that I'd maybe call the start of the second act of the story.
That scene's quite funny because he draws a rat. He's talking about historical sort of mass panic and fear and so on. He talks about things like the Great Plague, 17th century, and the Fire of London and so on. And so he draws a rat to illustrate this. They think it's a beaver, so the show is deliberately saying his drawing is bad. And then he also gets key details about plague and the Great Fire of London wrong. And also, when he writes fear, I don't know if you guys noticed this, when he writes the word fear on the blackboard, he kind of messes up one of the letters and then goes back to correct it. And I can't believe that they didn't do another take, you know, for something as simple as that. But anyway.
I do want to say they also got one of my favorite minor character details in this episode, where the professor was previously established as being agoraphobic, and Darius, the blonde kid who is sort of his assistant, is now established as being claustrophobic, which I find a really funny dichotomy.
Yeah, that is, honestly, I actually quite like the scene where the professor calls Darius out as being claustrophobic and Darius's handling of it, which is maybe played slightly for laughs, but I actually think Darius's position that it's his own issue and he's working on it in his own time is quite mature and reasonable.
Yeah.
And he's not then in any way forced to overcome his fear. Structurally, the episode respects that, even if the tone in which it's conveyed is almost like it's a bit of a joke.
Yeah, and Starkey sort of volunteers, doesn't he, to sort of save Darius' face, which I thought was kind of weirdly sweet in a way. Like,
yeah, that is actually quite an emotionally mature choice, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I like Darius being a bit of a blowhard. There's a sort of young Dean Winchester vibe to him that I appreciate.
Although it is funny, you won't know this, Moon, because you've not seen the other episodes, but he does have a secret hideout in a sewer, which is an odd choice for somebody who is claustrophobic.
They'll never suspect. Also, this is television. In all media, sewers are absurdly spacious.
That is true, and they are here as well, in fairness. Yes. So, yeah, they're massive.
Now, I did say, actually, the beaver raises a point, because I did want to say about the setting of the story, which is, obviously, as everyone knows, this is an Australian series and is presumably set in Australia. Indeed, I was working on a hypothesis before watching the episode that, if anything, what this proves is that K-9 cannot go to Australia and it be canon. Because if K-9 goes to... If the Doctor were to show up in Australia, it would be implicitly part of the broad thing that we loosely and jokingly refer to as canon within Doctor Who. Obviously, it happened. The Doctor went there. That's canon, right? Classic episode where the Doctor goes to Australia, say, for instance, the pilot, I think, for a show-offy TARDIS intro sequence. Whereas if K-9 goes to Australia, apparently it doesn't count, and we have all agreed this simply does not count, which I think would make K-9 a flat earther.
Is this a good time to mention the show is supposed to be set in London?
Well, I did pick this up about halfway through the episode. I will give them something resembling credit that sort of backwards accidental credit. I don't know. It's complicated. All of the aerial establishing shots of the city are in no way clear that this is specifically London. They're quite nice shots of a major metropolitan area featuring a river at night, but that could be any city in Europe.
That's actually distinctive to this episode, because I think previous ones we've had slightly clearer establishing shots of London, and this one, it's because it's doing the rioting thing. There's a lot of stuff at night with all this kind of smoke going up in the sky and stuff, and it is not clear that it is London, so I can see how actually you would have got quite confused.
This brings me round to my concluding hypothesis.
Go for it.
This is Melbourne. This is not London. What's going on is this fascist dictatorial regime, which you may need to fill me in on some of how it works, because I don't know what CCPC stands for, or what any of these people's jobs are, or anything about how this works, or whether there's a curfew. Are people allowed out during the day or nighttime? Because they seem concerned about ever doing that. And
we have no answers to any of this.
Okay. They
have a freaking football match. That's just not what I picture in dystopia.
Yeah. But anyway, a thing that this dictatorial government is doing is gaslighting the people of Melbourne, Australia.
Into thinking they're living in London.
That they're the citizens of London, England. Yes, that's part of their thing. And
this is probably more coherent than the show.
I think they're putting acid in the water. I think they're putting ketamine in the air. I think that's what's going on.
Can I just mention one of my theories for why this episode in particular was such a train wreck?
You would identify this as especially bad, Kevin.
I personally would. And looking at the credits, I think is revealing, because this one is credited to two writers, one of whom only ever worked on this script, and the other of whom's only other credit is a co-credit with a different episode. I'm thinking that the one writer did a bad job and the other one is the person they get in to save these things and did not do a good job saving it.
Yeah, they need a better fix-it guy. Whereas, Tom, I got the impression that you honestly thought that this one wasn't too bad, so...
It is completely incoherent. I just was... I appreciated the fact that it tried to do something with K-9. I mean, I think it flounders completely, but that does place it sort of almost at a bar above some of the episodes that have not found a use for him whatsoever. And I do like that this one was kind of going, okay, what's a story we can do with this character of K-9 as our lead? It's not a good story, but at least they tried.
Well, this might be a venue for something approximating my redemptive reading of it, or at least my wrestling with what I think it's trying to be about, because I think there is a fragment of a compelling idea in here, which is taking the character of K-9, who is a robot that very much feels human emotion but doesn't realize that he does, and using that as an angle to explore the way that... So, obviously, the basic structure of the episode is an incredibly staple genre trope that pretty much every monster of the week, genre property, Doctor Who, Power Rangers, Star Trek, Digimon, you know, they've all done at some point. The fear monster that makes you...
Yes.
Encounter and confront your fears, and it's supposed to be an opportunity to learn more about the characters, but it's seldom well written enough that we get any real depth on the characters. There are a few interesting examples within Doctor Who that can be rated against one another and would all rate well against this. But it's taking that stock trope and using that to explore the nature of subjectivity to some extent. Is the monster real or not? Now, this gets messy, because obviously within the universe, at some level, clearly, the power of metaphor and science fiction allows the subjective to become objective. Whether or not there is a baseline universe that we're all experiencing interpretations of, which is obviously K-9's position. The subjective experience of the people whose fears relate to closets does create an objective monster that other people who aren't afraid of closets can witness. That definitely happens. K-9 is able to go down into the hole.
Yep.
Initially, he's going to be able to go down because Starkey is afraid of losing him. But Starkey's fear of losing him teaches him that he's afraid of Jixon warriors. confusingly. But either way, even if he hadn't learned that valuable moral lesson and accepted that he, even though he is a robot, is able to experience subjectivity, he would still have been able to go down into the hole, presumably, because that was the initial plan.
And then he just gets to pop back out of the hole saying, "We."
Yes, he somehow manages to overcome his fear because earlier Starkey told him that the thing you're afraid of isn't real or something, which, you know, is a great tip.
And there's a bomb there, and there's a lot going on.
There's a bomb, yes. I actually want to mention
Alien Buster.
They tried to... The Alien Buster, yes, the best name ever. they tried to drop this Alien Buster bomb down the... Well, no, they succeed in dropping it down into the pit that is within the wardrobe. And apparently... It's going to go off, and yet this never kind of is satisfactorily resolved about if this causes any problem dropping a bomb down sort of somewhere within a major city.
It's a very cavalier attitude to the idea that you can definitely drop a bomb into a hole that only subjectively exists, and it won't blow you up.
And then Drake, the character with the robot hand, as you said earlier, Moon, just hits the wardrobe, and it just splinters into fragments for some reason.
Oh, that's
and then
amazing.
there's a voice just saying, "I'm fear, I will always be with you," or whatever it is.
So it was it an alien, maybe.
So it was. Yes, this is never answered, as we were sort of talking at the start, saying at the start. And it's bizarre. It's a really weird, rushed ending, even in this show. It's... I don't know if anyone else has any sort of greater thoughts on this.
I think what this episode is going to be for us is there's been a few times in this show where something just truly bizarre and strange has happened, and then we just can't stop mentioning it because it's absolutely hilarious that they made it onto TV. This episode was just a steady stream of those moments, which means it's absolutely terrible television, but it is damn satisfying to podcast about.
Yes, it is solid gold for future anecdotes.
I'll be dining out on this for years, I'll give you that.
Well, thank you, Moon, for joining us. I can't believe that was your first podcast, because you took it right away. You should really start your own. Since you've already told us where we can find you, I will just quickly plug ourselves. I'm Kevin, as ever, can be found at Scribble Script on Twitter.
As usual, I'll be running the K-9 Binge Quake Twitter account. And if you're not following that already and listening to this, then, you know, what are you doing?
Thank you very much for joining us this week, Moon.
All right. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Cheers.
Bye. You have been listening to K-9 Binge Quake with your hosts Tom Marshall, Kevin Bernard, and special guest Moon. This episode, "My Binary System Is Not Happy, Let's Boogie," was recorded 15th of January 2023 and was edited by Kevin Bernard. Theme music was composed by Jack Geidera. Thank you for listening, and remember, the closet is just your own fear. Or society's fear? There's something in there, but we don't have time to make sense of it.